There are, on average, 3 train derailments in the United States every single day. 3. That's more than 1,000 derailments every year. Most of those are not serious enough to make the news, but some are disasters. Trains derail while carrying dangerous chemicals or petroleum products. They catch fire. They contaminate land and groundwater. They lead to the death of farm animals and sometimes even railroad employees and members of the public. Why is safety such a serious issue in the American railroad industry? Why is the United States so very far behind the rest of the developed world when it comes to its railroads? And why has the government, over the course of decades, over the course of a century, done almost nothing about it? I'm John Kiriakou. Welcome to The Whistleblowers. Here in the United States, we're proud of the fact that we invented railroads. They were a product of American ingenuity in the middle of the 19th century. It was the railroads that opened the West for settlement. Railroads made it possible for Americans to settle California and to make it what it is today. Railroads made it possible for huge amounts of goods to be carried efficiently and cost-effectively from one corner of the country to the other. So why hasn't the American railroad industry evolved like it has in the rest of the developed world? Why, for example, does the U.S. not have bullet trains? Why do many of the tunnels that our trains use date to the period of the American Civil War in the 1860s? Why are trains sometimes so long that they block emergency vehicles like ambulances from getting people to hospitals until they die? Why does the United States not have a truly national passenger train system like most other countries do? And why do they seem to constantly derail, often causing environmental disasters and the loss of life? The reasons are severalfold. First, this is a failure of policy. Members of Congress are lobbied constantly by representatives for the airlines, who most certainly do not want a national train system. Those lobbyists also make huge campaign contributions to members of Congress that, in the end, keep them in line and voting for the airlines over the railroads. But another reason is corporate greed. Why spend money on infrastructure when the federal government isn't committed to it anyway? Why not just take the money that otherwise would have been spent and put it in the pockets of corporate executives and stockholders? Why not make trains longer? So long when they pass through a town that everything has to come to a halt, literally, until they pass. That would save money, after all, and it would lead to even bigger profits. The most important issue here is, of course, safety. It seems like safety always comes second to profits. How in the world did it become so normal in the United States to have 3 railroad derailments every single day? More than 1,000 a year. How did that become so normal that it's not even reported in the media anymore? Again, it's a perfect storm of corporate greed and policy failure. We have a guest today who is able to offer some unique insights into this problem. Michael Paul Lindsay II is a military veteran who worked for the Union Pacific Railroad as a trained locomotive conductor and engineer for more than 17 years. He has maintained good standing as an employee throughout that entire time. And also, over the course of that career, he has been a noted whistleblower. Paul has seen and experienced firsthand how corporate greed has destroyed the railroad industry, damaged the U.S. supply chain, abused workers, and put the public in danger. Paul also is unusual among whistleblowers. He has been public about his revelations, putting them on his popular TikTok channel, writing op-eds, and giving interviews like this one. And what happens to whistleblowers like Paul, even those who make protected revelations, those who speak out for the public good? They're retaliated against and often fired, and that's what happened to Paul. Paul, we're so happy to have you with us on the show. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me on your show, John. I'm glad to be here.
Paul, I normally start the show by asking some of the big questions related to whistleblowing and to policy, but I'd like to reverse that today, and I'd like to start by talking about you as a person. Your story is so fascinating for a number of reasons. First, you've been public about speaking truth to power. You haven't hidden your whistleblowing. You've been front and center with it. And everything you've said has been to the public benefit. You talk about safety, you talk about corporate greed, you talk about the railroads failing the public. Tell us about when and how you made the decision to go public with your observations and experiences, and why did you do that?
So it's been a long time coming. I actually have been following the share buyback program and the outright neglect of our industry and the infrastructure for quite a few years. And funny, actually, about 6 years ago, the corporate leadership at Union Pacific, the CEO, CFO, came and did a town hall meeting in Pocatello. And the whole room was full of people, full of employees. And they figured we'd be asking normal questions. I stood up and I asked Rob Knight at the time, our CFO, why is Union Pacific burning our working capital and destroying our future prosperity by putting all of our money into share buybacks every year instead of growing our business? And I got the most polite screw you I've ever gotten in my entire life. But it was interesting when that went about, just the amount of disdain that they had when you actually try to ask why our industry is not growing. So something to put out there is that every year these companies put more into share buybacks by far than they do any sort of capital investment. And I was noticing that at the time, and it just kept getting worse and worse and worse. But when all the COVID stuff started, and then these companies ended up getting preferential money from the Federal Reserve, I saw as they got preferential loans, just like other healthy companies got. Meanwhile, our contract is a couple years expired, and they're trying to play hardball on our contracts, and the unions aren't really trying to actually negotiate for anything, especially when we lost our ability to write off our non-taxable meal. So when the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act was passed, that happened to change the work environment for transportation workers because it took away our ability to effectively write off our meals every year. And if you're on the road 200 or more days per year, you're eating that expense and you're getting taxed on all of it. It made me very angry. It really, especially watching the industry start to, through the precision scheduled railroading, cut safety, cut track maintenance, cut equipment maintenance, started to see derailment spiking, starting to do that in every single way, and yet they don't even want to come to the table to negotiate with us. So I started to actually become more and more, obsessive with trying to change our industry for the better. And that's when I started my TikTok channel and started making some little videos about the railroad to make people think a little bit. Who owns these companies? Who actually controls these companies? And who is this money that our vital infrastructure, vital transportation infrastructure rely on? Who is that money actually going to? And that's also when I started writing op-eds to submit to RailWage and that went to the Surface Transportation Board federal hearings. That's kind of how it started. And I just kept getting deeper and deeper into it. I also serve on the media committee at Railroad Workers United, which are like-minded individuals that speak to the media about how the industry is changing, what's going on in the industry. Since the company itself, they're not going to talk about it. We are the people that will actually get this information out there.
I've read many of your op-eds, and I've seen your excellent TikTok channel. You talk about serious and important issues there. These are issues, one way or another, that affect every American. When you first started doing this, what was the response from the railroad? Did it take them by surprise?
Well, I believe they tried to ignore me. They absolutely tried to ignore me, and even my local management and all, they knew what I was doing. And they weren't against it at all. It was, in fact, I've gotten, quite a bit of compliments from management and the ranks appreciating what I was doing. They didn't do anything. They tried to pretend it didn't exist. It did not. They did not pursue retaliation until the East Palestine derailment happened and I started making content related to East Palestine, which, you know, fell, even though it was Norfolk Southern that this happened to, my content made the point that this applies to all railroads and they're all doing this with their hot box detectors, where you have someone hundreds of miles away that is monitoring the detectors now, and the crews are not being alerted to the status of their train, right? And I made this video, and this is when it hit the fan. After I'd made dozens of videos, that was, and also spoken on the media. By this time, I'd already spoken to, I don't know how many podcasts. I'd been on, you know, Morning in America. I'd been a few times. I'd been on NBC Nightly News. I'd been all, and they just ignored it. They did nothing. But when I started talking about East Palestine, that is when I was pulled out of service and they escorted me off the property and pulled me into formal investigation.
Besides your public revelations, have you approached any governmental or oversight entities? After all, much of what you talk about has to do with public safety.
So I have. I've spoken extensively with Robert Primus at the Surface Transportation Board. They're a railroad regulatory agency. And actually, this year in March, when I was out there, I actually met with them for lunch, you know, to speak about the industry. And that was in Washington, D.C., right across from the Capitol. It was a very interesting experience. Never thought I'd be in that position. But unfortunately, his body is mostly to do with the economic side of the railroad, because a lot of it has been, how is this affecting our economy, which also translates to safety, because if the railroads are driving away business to trucks, that puts our freight on the unsafe highway system that's subsidized by the taxpayers and potentially causes more death and destruction on our highways, right? And you know, the Surface Transportation Board, they were the ones that have been holding hearings before the East Palestine, before the safety stuff really, really came to the public forefront. And then I've also reached out and tried to contact several congressmen and senators that have proposed pieces of legislation. However, thus far, any legislative effort has been met with lawsuits from the railroad, whether it be federal or state. They seem to think that they're invincible. And so, to give an example of this, I actually made a 10-minute video that was used for Nevada Assembly Bill 456, I believe it was, and it was used in the hearings to get this piece of legislation passed on a state level. And the representative from Union Pacific there told the state in the hearing with no sort of reservation whatsoever that Union Pacific will immediately be filing lawsuits against the state if they proceed with this. So I've been involved in on a state level also. This happened to be Nevada. I could have been doing a lot more. I got to say, I'd love to do a lot more, but I have been, that's been my engagement as far as federal and state.
Thank you, Paul. Stay right there. We want to continue this conversation. We're speaking with American Railroad whistleblower Michael Paul Lindsay II about railroad safety and about his experience as a whistleblower in this important sector. We're going to take a short break and come back to talk about the current and future states of American railroads and why they are such a mess.
We need to counter the Russian state-controlled narrative.
Als Teil der Sanktionen gegen Russland gehen die westlichen Länder gegen russische Auslandssender vor.
Mais écoutez, monsieur, c'est pas à vous de décider de qui est journaliste ou pas dans ce pays. On est en France, quoi. C'est pas possible.
We will ban in the European Union the Kremlin's media machine. The state-owned Russia Today and Sputnik.
RT, Sputnik, even our video agency, roughly all banned on YouTube.
Et merci à vous tous pour votre fidélité et votre soutien. known in Vietnam as the American War, the Vietnam War lasted for almost two decades and dragged in numerous countries.
Nhưng mà người cầm đầu của Mỹ nói rằng sang Việt Nam là như thế giúp Việt Nam. Và thì còn anh em thì không thống kê được.
Hundreds of thousands of American troops were sent to the country to bag the South Vietnamese Army.
Má bay rồi nó xả. Xóa cho mày đâu có biết cái chất lực đấy, không biết cái tập kinh mà ta này mới biết, ta này nha, nói là đó là chất tập quá à.
American soldiers murdered resistors mercilessly, burned down entire villages and spread dangerous chemicals.
Cần nghĩ lại những người Mỹ, những người lính Mỹ rất trẻ và họ nhận thức không.
Did the Americans ever fully acknowledge what they did? And are the Vietnamese veterans ready to forgive?
Chẳng nhận là gia đình chúng tôi mất mất trong chiến tranh, mà cả quê hương đất nước cũng bị mất mất trong cái sự đau thương của gia đình Mỹ.
Welcome back to The Whistleblowers. I'm John Kiriakou. We're speaking with American Railroad whistleblower Michael Paul Lindsay II about his very unique experiences and about his whistleblowing on safety and corporate greed. Paul, welcome back to the show. Paul, I grew up 15 miles from East Palestine, Ohio, which was the site of an absolutely horrible train derailment and chemical spill earlier this year. Literally the entire town was evacuated. Farm animals died for miles around, and the groundwater was contaminated. The government was very slow to react, and in the end, railroad executives promised a few dollars to those families who had been affected, and the railroad announced that it would build a park. A park. This is a disaster on so many levels. First, tell us how a derailment and a spill like this could happen. And second, tell us how the railroads get away with causing such destruction.
Okay. Well, the cause of the East Palestine derailment is very simple, and it was just an overheated bearing. I mean, you figure if you've ever pulled a trailer, yeah, something you just got to watch out for. You know, you get bearings that occasionally overheat. It's just something you got to watch for. And on the railroad, they have detectors that they typically place every so often along the rails that scan these wheels as they go by, scan these bearings. And the way it's always been is we'll go over them with our train and it broadcasts out over the radio. And the crew, the conductor and the engineer in the cab can hear it. And it'll announce the milepost, you know, milepost 233. Milepost 233.5, no defects. Total axles gives you an axle count. Train speed, and a lot of times it would say the temperature, which is a big deal because it's nice to know what the temperature is outside because it affects train handling as an engineer. It affects your brakes, how effective your brakes are and everything else. If the temperature has dropped dramatically, it has an effect on train operations. So it was a good piece of information. So in the last few years, these detectors, as these companies have been just obsessive about lowering their operating ratio at any cost, cutting maintenance, cutting track department, cutting train crews, cutting everything they can. One thing they've done is they don't want to see trains stopped. So, you know, you don't want to have to stop a train so that a conductor has to check for a hot bearing. Oh, that just cost the shareholders money, even though it's an overheated bearing. So what they do now, and this is what I called out in my video that the railroad used to fire me, is that now they've shut off all those exit messages on the detectors, and they go to someone hundreds of miles away, and you know, it sends an alert to their desk, and they look at it. Meanwhile, they're managing hundreds of trains. And it's easy to not catch that. The equivalent of this would be like, imagine if you're on a plane and there's some sort of engine failure on the plane, but the airline has a policy, well, we don't want to let the pilot or anything make a judgment call on that. So even though there's an engine problem, we're going to send it to headquarters and have them look at it. And if we decide, maybe we'll let the pilot know that there's a problem. You know, that's absolutely unacceptable. So that is what happened with East Palestine. There was a bearing failure, and that single bearing failure, even though it seems like one, you have hundreds of axles on these trains, that one single bearing failure causes a rail car to fail, causes it to derail. But since you have all those other cars around it, it causes a pileup and a whole bunch more cars derail. So even though it was just one bearing, it causes a massive derailment. You do not want to have a catastrophic bearing failure. So that's what I made that video on. I do want to point out that just a couple days ago, there was a news article that was that was released. An investigative journalist put out an article specifically on this and specifically cited this. And it is now publicly reported by the mainstream media that that's exactly what happened. And there used to be two employees in that, you know, little cubicle hundreds of miles away in Atlanta monitoring all the trains on the UP. Now there was only one. And here you have this one guy sitting there monitoring every train on the Norfolk Southern for these problems because they've silenced all the detectors. The train crews can't make the decision anymore. And he missed it. He doesn't have a designated bathroom break. He doesn't have a designated lunch break. He works a 12-hour shift. And he said he was working three other trains at the time and missed the, you know, he missed the detector when it read 103 degrees on the previous detector when the train went over it. So that's how it happened. It was cost cutting, getting rid of employees. That, so even though it was a bearing that caused it, it was cost cutting, and it was the obsession with lowering the operating ratio that caused this. And this is, you know, and this is not the only case of that. The same week, we had another big piece of information released. So there was a Amtrak derailment in Montana a couple years ago that killed three people. Okay, and the final NTSB report came out on this, and the report stated that it was track maintenance. The crews were overworked. There were two guys working that section of track, and over the previous 4 months, it said that they had worked an average of 13 hours a day, and they didn't have enough people out there, and there hadn't been a walking inspection of the rail in something like 2 years. And so again, it goes back to cost cutting. How do we give BlackRock and Vanguard more money? How do we cut the operation to the core? How do we prevent putting any of their own capital into the railroad so we can give it back to the shareholders as buybacks? So cuts. That's what caused East Palestine.
I mentioned in the introduction to the show that American railroads are generations behind their European, Chinese, and Japanese counterparts. We have no bullet trains. It seems like our trains are never on time. Passenger travel is discouraged in favor of air travel. Why is it like this? Why are we so far behind?
Well, there's definitely a lot of reason. We could talk for 2 hours on this subject about the way our cities are designed, the way they're designed around the car and highway infrastructure. It's a very, very deep issue. But bottom line, I think the reason why our railroads are so far behind is because we have allowed these companies to consolidate into giant monopolies, and they have the right to not invest in growth. So imagine if our highway system, or maybe our airline system, hadn't improved since the 1960s. It had just stayed in the same position it was since the 1960s. We'd be saying that our highway and our airline system was antiquated. But that is what has happened with the railroads. Yeah, they've gotten some new locomotives, but really very little has changed. They haven't invested into double track, electrification, longer sidings. There's been very, very little investment. There's just been consolidation and abandonment of track. And as far as passenger rail, you know, of course, they couldn't even though federal law requires them to give Amtrak priority on their tracks, the railroads have made this decision now that they'll run 12, 13, 14, 15,000 foot trains. They'll run them as long as they want. through your hometown, while at the same time, their sidings, a lot of times, are only 7,000 or 8,000 feet. So even if Amtrak wanted to get around them, they can't because there's no place to pass. And the railroads don't care. They just flat out do not care. The reason for all of this is because the railroads are privately owned, and they are allowed, we don't enforce common carrier obligations anymore. We don't really have any standard on what is considered good service anymore. And the highways and the airports and every other mode of transportation, even like maritime transportation, let's say the dredging of the rivers, the ports, we maintain that as vital public infrastructure in the United States. But yet when it comes to rail, they're allowed to essentially do whatever they want. And that is the difference between what we have and what they have over in Europe. And I'm not saying that we need to just nationalize and run government freight trains at all. I believe that the freight rail or the rail system should be treated the same way as the highway system and the airports. You know, open access, and it has to be maintained at that point. And you're constantly seeing bridges being rebuilt and new interchanges being put in and modernization going into our freeways and our highways and our airports and everything else. You don't see that on the railroads. You don't see it. A lot of times we still have 15-mile-an-hour switches out there where the train has to slow down to 15 miles an hour to go from one track to the other because we just – and meanwhile, in January, I was over in Italy, and I was on a train going, 300 kilometers an hour. we do not prioritize. We do not prioritize rail in the United States, and we allow them to be a monopoly, even though I'm no law professor, but I do believe that having a monopoly or attempting to have a monopoly has been illegal in the United States for a lot of years now. We have the Sherman Antitrust Act, as well as several others, some jurisprudence to lean back on, and we don't enforce that anymore. Monopolies are allowed and even encouraged now in America. And I don't mean to ramble on about this. I'll tie it all off there in this topic by stating that so as far as public ownership of the rail versus like the interstates, imagine our interstate highway system. For the most part, they have problems, but for the most part, we have hundreds of different trucking companies. They compete, and for the most part, it works out okay. No one is suggesting that a trucking company should own an interstate. That would be ridiculous, and no one would even consider that as reasonable, but that's what we do with the railroads.
Paul, thank you for joining us, and thank you for your bravery in practically single-handedly standing up to one of the most powerful industries in the United States. It's not easy, and Paul is living proof of that. After a 17-year career preceded by proud military service, he's out of a job simply for telling the truth. Every country needs whistleblowers, of course. They're crucial to a healthy society. The employee who, in the public interest, has the independence of judgment and the personal courage to challenge malpractice or illegality is a public hero. That's Paul Lindsay. We need more people like him. Thanks for joining us for another episode of The Whistleblowers. I'm John Kiriakou. We'll see you next time.